We're rolling.
Excellent.
Dr. Mark Knight here again. It's always weird calling you doctor. You're like my mate who I call doctor.
I can't fix you though. If you're broke, I can't fix you.
So I think we alluded to this on a previous podcast that we did, that you were working on something big. And, you know, when you first told me about this kind of, you know, almost like tribute or monument to the river goddess.
Yes.
In an area where some rivers meet, I was like, oh, that'd be pretty cool. That'd be all right. Yeah. Oh, lovely. Oh.
Yeah.
And then you sent me a picture of what has actually happened. And I was like, oh God, I didn't expect that. That's like a prop. That's a massive proper thing.
It is. It's a sculpture of a river goddess with three faces, and it stands around 5 foot, 1.5 meters, something like that. But it's on a sort of elevated on a raised mound.
Yeah,
slightly. The sculpture looks sort of northwestish. Towards the Catome ceremonial complex, which was created in prehistory, and it's partly to celebrate that, but mostly it's to celebrate the that confluence, that triple confluence of rivers. It stands in a nature reserve that's owned by Staffordshire Wildlife Trust, and that who I work for. I've got an easy way in to go and talk to the right people about getting the permission for us to be able to get this sculpture installed there, and they were great about it. Of course,
I have to say the pitch, the conversation. Right, I want to do a statue of a three-headed goddess where the rivers meet, and point it towards this sort of Neolithic or prehistoric ceremonial complex in Catome. How do you pitch that?
So for a start. It's not just me. It's a team. It's a team effort. The whole thing is a team effort. So I'd done the research work. I picked up on earlier research work and developed it slightly. Had some ideas about it that I think came about by being in the landscape. So it's very easy to theorize from a distance, you know, from your office or your room or your bedroom or whatever. But the reality of being out in the landscape and spending a lot of time in the landscape, you start to think and feel differently about that space.
Yeah.
So to answer your question about getting the right permissions in place, I work for the trust. I work with a team of people, and we couldn't have installed this without that team. It's not a me, it's an us.
Very definitely.
But I'd had this desire to create some kind of landscape art for a little while. And it dawned on me that this was the perfect thing that we could do. So as the cultural heritage officer for the Staffordshire Wildlife Trust, I look after, I get people to consider cultural heritage when we're making vast sort of great landscape changes, river restoration work, all sorts of things. We need to consider the historic environment. We can come back to that point. But what that meant was that I asked my project manager if we could create new cultural heritage, thinking she'd just say no chance. And she didn't really say anything at first, and came back with this. So she got the interpretation. We have an interpretation officer, Mari, and she got Mari on board. Mari has got all the right connections to get the right artists in place, to create those sculptures, to create the sculpture. So it's that knowing people who know people.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's working with a really great team. I have to say they're a really great team. And being able to have the right people to talk to get that sculpture in the right place. So it's the sculpture is on trust property.
Yeah.
That property happens to be right where that confluence is.
Right.
So that's important. To get it there is important. And I think the thing to think here about, before we go any further, I really ought to say this is, although it's open to the public and people are encouraged to go and visit, and have a look at the sculpture, primarily it's a nature reserve.
Right.
So,
okay.
So there are areas that people are not allowed to go. It's set aside in purely for wildlife. There are areas where you're allowed to take your dog on a lead, and there are areas where people can go with no dogs.
Mm.
That's an important point to make, because wildlife and people don't mix that well.
Okay. Yeah.
As I'm sure you're aware.
Yeah.
So we are encouraging people to go, but unfortunately, it's in an area where you can't take your dog. Because they just scare the wildlife away, and it's a great area for wetland birds, for nesting and all sorts of things. So anyway,
there's an aspect of respect to that, isn't there?
It's about
respecting nature, respecting
absolutely
the world
around you,
that sort of thing. You know, it's not all about you and your experience. It's actually about having the experience, enjoy it.
Be close to nature, be involved with nature, observe nature, try and connect with nature if you can, but be aware that the nature comes first.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But that's part of the whole sort of goddess thing, you know.
Yes.
So this is in the landscape, and you're encouraged to go. It's at Croxall Lakes,
which is
Staffordshire Wildlife Trust Nature Reserve. We encourage people to go there. The reason it came about was because, Katoam Ceremonial Complex, number one. I didn't know about this until January 2021, and I read about the Katoam Ceremonial Complex, and it was one of those moments where I thought, how can I possibly have lived as the crow flies, it's maybe 5 miles from my house.
Yes, yeah.
How can I have lived here all my life and not known about this?
Mm-hmm. Because, and be into the things that you're into.
So this ceremonial complex is of national importance. It's on the River Trent is probably, arguably anyway, the most significant river in prehistoric terms.
Yeah.
Because just the sheer volume of prehistory or prehistoric monuments that are along its banks. And this particular confluence in the central sort of area of the River Trent is where that focus lies.
Okay.
So everything comes together there. There are other confluences and there are other important sites. I mean, I'm talking of national importance sites along the River Trent, but this is where the focus, certainly along the central reaches of the River Trent, is at Katoam. And when you go there, there's absolutely nothing whatsoever to see. So it's all under farmland.
Okay.
So the only way it was found out about was from aerial photography, and then in 2004 there was a quite significant archaeological intervention or dig by Birmingham Archaeological Unit. They were based at the university at the time, and they were able to find out an awful lot more about these monuments, of which there are three.
Mm.
The first was a cursus, and that's probably more than 5,000 years that was created. And a cursus is a pair of parallel ditches.
Right.
They can be varying widths, but from memory, I think these are, I'm going to say, 45 meters apart.
Okay.
That kind of size. And they would have been...
They're quite big,
Quite wide.
Yeah.
Quite far apart, quite long in the, and these things vary across the country.
Yeah.
They're rare things to find in the country anyway. I think there are some 80 odd, and there are more to be discovered, but at the moment the number is that kind of number.
And what are they called again?
Cursus.
Cursus.
Right. When they were first discovered, it was believed that they were like a kind of Roman amphitheatre for horse racing.
They're
very long and very narrow, effectively, and it's a ditch with a bank on the outside. So they're not defensive in nature, but they are. They enclose some land for unknown purposes.
Yeah,
thought to be probably religious or ritual in some way.
Yes,
in some way. And they're capped at either end by. So if you imagine a very long, narrow rectangle. Of ditches 2 meters deep with banks on the outside.
Yes.
From the spoil. That's what you've got in the landscape.
Right.
They're often aligned on a significant, in this case, they're aligned east-west. So
yeah.
They're aligned on the spring and autumn equinoxes.
Mm-hmm.
But part of it's lost. Part of it goes under more modern farm
Right.
So we've no idea how long it was. It can't have been longer than the river, perhaps.
Right.
But you know where the river was, it's moved.
Yeah.
And that was the first monument, this Cursus monument. Aligned on that is a monument that's known as the Sunburst. We don't know what they called it or whether it was even intended to represent a sunburst. But what it is a series of radiating pits.
Okay.
Quite large.
Yeah.
And then at some point, so that was perhaps 4,500-ish years ago that was created.
Yeah.
So the Cursus was still in the monument. The Cursus monument was still in the landscape and visible.
Yeah.
Because this is aligned on it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And then at some point, the inner row of pits was turned into a henge, which is people always think that like Stonehenge is the henge is the upright stones.
Yeah, it's not.
It's the ditch and bank.
Yeah.
And
it's the same as when people call it a Motton Bailey castle. And it's not the castle isn't the Motton Bailey. The Motton Bailey is the Bailey.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. And then there's a castle on the top.
Yeah.
In this instance, the inner row of pits was turned into a henge.
Mm.
So there was quite a large ditch and bank inside these pits that some archaeologists argue that they never had. There's no evidence that they ever had posts in, but it's possible that they did.
Right, yeah.
It's possible that they did. So if they did, they would have had fairly large, substantial forest oak tree posts.
Yes.
That was the second monument. The third monument is a wood henge style monument. This did not have a henge at all, but it's a series of very large oak posts, trees, in fact.
Right.
Forest trees that were set in a circle that enclosed a circular area in the middle. The posts were quite close together.
Yeah.
I think there are 39 in each. There are five rows of 39. The inner enclosed area is sort of between 23, 25 metres, and they stretch out then to about, off the top of my head, I'm going to say 60 or 70 metres
to
the outer. So, and that would have created a very almost invisible central space in which, who knows what happened, but it would again, kind of probably ritual space, maybe a space for observing the stars, maybe a space for making sound sound that we, you know, chanting or something like that, that would, but what that does is sets a small area aside for a limited amount of people to be able to occupy at once. So that sort of speaks of a congregation. We're talking in terms that we really actually don't know what happened. We don't know whether the posts were left as bark on trunks. We don't know whether they were carved like totem poles.
Okay, yeah,
we
yeah,
know
yeah.
nothing, yeah. anything about them. All we know is the remains of them. Some of them sit in these in the post holes.
Must be hard to predict, though. That idea of like, right, there was something there. This is what it was.
Yeah,
we kind of don't really know what it was, and we don't really know what it was for.
Correct,
but it must have been important.
Yes, because a lot of effort went into the creation of it. So it's quite interesting, these post holes. Some are perfectly circular, and they're about 1 to 1.2 metres across, a metre or so deep. So they held substantial forest trees.
Mm.
Some of them are circular, and some of them have got like a sort of slot on one side. And that's been interpreted as different teams of people installing those posts.
Yeah.
And it could be family units. It could be... groups from different areas. No one knows, but it's apparent that these posts were erected by different people.
Yeah,
and that could be people who were experienced in it, going straight into the ground with the circular. The ones with the slots, perhaps less experienced, so they needed a kind of runway into the hole so they could get it in there, then pull it erect. It's quite interesting just looking at the archaeology itself. But we really don't know an awful lot about these places, apart from they were significant enough for a lot of people to come together to put effort into making something that got no apparent reason.
Clearly there's
a reason, but we don't know what
that was.
Not at all.
Yeah.
So it's circumspect, really, in what we try and work out what happened in there, but clearly it was important to them.
Yeah.
And it's probably... Yeah. pseudo-religious-y, in a way that we don't know. We don't even know what language they spoke.
No,
nothing.
No, no.
You know, we don't know.
Yeah,
an awful lot about them. But
so say again, what kind of timescale are we talking about?
So from the cursus beginning, yep, about just over 5,000 years ago,
yeah,
to the point at which it was kind of closed off, if you like.
Yeah.
It lasted maybe 2,500 years in total. So it's perhaps a little bit less than that. Perhaps around about 1,500 to 2,000 years, because a burial was inserted in the middle of the sunburst monument, which was clearly no longer in use at that point.
Yes,
but it must have been visible in the landscape.
A burial
or an interment was made there.
Yeah, yeah.
In the Middle Bronze Age.
Yeah.
So we've gone from the late Neolithic to the early to the Middle Bronze Age.
I mean, that's beautiful because in a way that's sort of like, because no one's talking to each other over those time periods, are they?
So they're the inheritors of these things.
Yeah,
and maybe by the time you get to the Woodhenge Monument, it means something different to when you create the cursus. You know.
But everyone goes, well, someone put loads of time into this, so let's look after it.
It's important. Let's add to it.
And sometimes
they're recut.
So as
the banks slump back into the ditches, at some point they decide, right, we're going to clear the ditches and make the banks bigger again, or you know, recreate the post holes, or
people fascinated.
Absolutely fascinating. So that's one thing.
Yeah.
There's the ceremonial complex.
Yeah.
Then the other thing we were trying to do, or that I'd been looking into, was what does the river name mean? What does Trent mean?
Yeah.
And there's been a...
And it's Trent, what's the...
There's the Trent, the Meese, and the Tame.
The
Tame comes out of... sort of the Birmingham Black Country area, effectively picking up smaller rivers as it comes in. And it's actually quite a big river by the time it gets to there, but back then it wouldn't have been so big.
No.
The reason it's so large now is because we've got this enormous conurbation, which is pulling water out of Wales to use for baths, toilets, drinking, all the rest of it, tipping into the, and that ends up in the river. So the Tame is, by the time it meets the Trent, is now a large river.
Yes.
In a very different way to how it would have been in the past.
Yeah.
Even so you've got, and then the Meese comes in from sort of Leicestershire, Derbyshire.
Yeah.
You know, and comes down that way. It's a smaller river and still is a smaller river. But even just the other day it had flooded and I couldn't get across that way. I had to go a long way around. But, you know, I'd been looking into what does the river name mean. And there's been a lot of work on this in the past. It was originally believed to mean the wanderer or the trespasser.
Yeah.
And that makes sense because, as we know, the middle reaches of the Trent flood.
You've only
got to think of the Burton Washlands.
We were driving over that this morning talking about it. Me and Rob were,
How wet that whole space
It's unbelievable.
Gets. And then some more work had been done on it, and it was thought to mean something along the lines of the great feminine thoroughfare, which is a very inelegant name. But the idea of that femininity of the river is important. And then a professor of linguistics called Andrew Brees, based at the University of Navarra, but he's English and he's got roots in Staffordshire. He had put forward a really strong theory that this river name means, it comes in two parts, tree.
Yeah.
And Huantona. So,
okay.
Huantona, something like that. Yeah. Something along those lines. And those parts mean, he thought that tree is related to tri, is related to the modern Welsh word dra, meaning great or very.
Okay.
And then Huant means something like desire
or
love. And then the honor is a modifier on the end of that. So what he was saying was that the name meant greatly desired or greatly beloved, but with a feminine sense to it.
Yeah, yeah.
What Professor Brees doesn't have is the time spent in the Trent Valley that I was talking about earlier. And that knowledge of the ceremonial complex, that knowledge of the confluence of three rivers and the three part of that point is important, I think, because I don't think tri means dra or very. I think tri means three.
As
in try. And it means that in almost every European language, it has Indo-European roots. So that means that same tri sound or thri or Drei in German, that same sound is evident across the sort of North Arabic, North Indian, European continents, that space. And I've communicated with Professor Breeze on this. We've exchanged emails, and he's a really nice fella.
Yeah.
And so so essentially what I was saying, that it meant three. And that meant that the river name means thrice beloved.
Okay. Yeah.
Because you've got that threeness of things. It's really important. So that threeness of femininity. So you have the three fates in Greek mythology. You have the three Norns in Norse mythology. And that goes on across Irish, other Celtic mythologies. Have that threeness of things.
Yeah.
The three witches in Shakespeare.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And that, I think, is really, really significant and really important, and that threeness gives that triple regard to the thrice beloved goddess of the river, where the three rivers come together and create one, the three that become one, that Trinity idea.
Yeah.
So we've discussed this, Andrew Breeze and I. He gave serious consideration to my proposal and ended up disagreeing with me. But he
nicely, I hope.
Very, very nicely. Yeah, he's genuinely a nice bloke. And we've continued to communicate. And we, in the end, we agreed that we were just going to have to not agree on this point. But it kind of matters, but it kind of doesn't. It's academic in more than one sense, if you like.
Yeah.
Because what that meant was that there was a focus, I believe, and this is, again, a proposal, I believe that the Catoum ceremonial complex was there because of the confluence of the three rivers, but also that it was considered to be, and this is my supposition, this is not fact, that it was considered to be the birthplace of the goddess, of the river goddess. And that was our starting point for the creation of this sculpture.
Yeah.
And then it got taken up by my colleagues.
Yeah.
They found two sculptors, Staffordshire-based sculptors, Miranda Wakeman and Geraint Lloyd, who came up with the initial concept was for a very different type of sculpture, much more classical. Almost sort of 1900s, 1920s, in that feel of that Art Nouveau feel to it. And it was lovely. And then we had a site meeting. They came to the site, and I discussed what I've just been discussing with you. And they said,
it can't be that.
Geraint said, I thought it had been put together by a committee because it ticks these boxes. Oh, river goddess, three heads, must be wearing a swan cloak or the swan feather cloak.
Yeah.
That kind of idea. I said, oh, no. All of these things are part of the mythology of the area. And part of the story, and they went away and redesigned
I understand that we've got. So they thought that you come up with the idea, in a committee and said, this is what it needs.
We'd like a thing.
Don't mean anything. It's just a nice thing.
Just a nice thing.
Wow.
And the reality
when you told them the
connection with connection with the landscape, the connection with place, was actually the important thing.
Yeah.
You know, they got it straight away. I mean, they're artists.
Yes.
And they've got that feel for place when they arrive.
Yeah.
And they went away and created a very beautiful sculpture. As you've seen the photos. We're just in the process of making a short sort of YouTube video about it. So it's available. But I do encourage anybody who's listening to this to just come and visit.
Come and see.
It's worth it. I think it's worth it.
Amazing. So when you sent me the sort of... I suppose you call it the press release. That's right.
Yeah, it's a press release. And there's it's now on the Staffordshire Wildlife Trust website.
Yeah.
A little bit about it.
It said about the word Trent coming from the word Tristan Toner or Tristan.
Yeah, that's right. So if you imagine Trochentona being gradually Trent.
Okay. Oh, wow.
I mean, we're talking over very long periods of time. We're talking about a 5,000-year evolution of a word.
Yeah.
Possibly less, because it's been called Trent for the last 500 years, maybe longer.
Yeah.
But we're talking about a contraction of a word in a language that people, they hear the word.
Yes.
and then they repeat it, and but they say it in their own way. We do it all the time with foreign words, that we you know, we absorb other cultures' languages into our own, and it, we pronounce it, we mangle and pronounce their language, but it becomes a word in our language.
Yeah.
And that, I think that there's another really interesting point. This is slightly an aside.
Yeah.
If you look at, so river names, place names and hill names tend to have a long history. Rivers and mountains and hills, their name gets fossilized, if you will, it gets fixed.
Yes.
So these words, and then they get pronounced differently by other people as they come in, but but if you notice, a lot of the river names, they begin with a d-ut sound, which is a dental fricative. It's where you put the tip of your tongue just behind your teeth on the roof of your mouth and make that sound d.
Yeah.
And so if you look at river names, many ancient river names, what we've got Thames, Trent, Tees, Tyne, Tamar, Dove, Dee, Tavy.
Wow.
These are very ancient names, river names, and they all begin with a very similar sound. Why that should be, I'm going to go back to Andrew Breeze and ask him for his professorial opinion on that. I don't know the answer to that, but it's an observation, and it's not my observation. It's been observed before me.
Yeah.
I just find it fascinating that there must be a reason for that sound. It must have meant something in the past to have that you know, that connection with the rivers. But anyway, the rivers are very significant, have always been. They link us through time and space.
Yeah.
With, whether we like it or not, with the peoples of the past, whatever we do with those rivers, and we've spent maybe the last, from the middle years of the 1900s, you know, the 20th century, we have befouled our rivers, probably for longer than that.
Yeah.
We have straightened our rivers. We have dredged our rivers to make them almost as lifeless as it's possible to make them. And what people like the Trust are doing is trying in some way to redress that balance a little bit, lowering the riverbanks, making areas of, you know, sort of gravel banks within the rivers to speed up the water flow, aerate the water. And just renaturalize the rivers a little bit, as much as possible. So just by Croxall, so my initial idea was, I'd like this goddess to stand in the river. So as it floods, she goes underwater and she reappears as the water. Recede.
That's a good idea.
It would have been a lovely idea.
Yeah.
Very difficult to do. Yeah. And we'd have had to get in the river and start damaging those banks.
Okay. So it defeats the object.
The Trust has been working for. So instead, she looks from Croxall towards the Catterham ceremonial complex. Just a very beautiful thing. It's almost finished. So at the moment, she looks quite stark because it's Portland stone. So it's very white.
Yeah.
And it stands on a raised mound of a sub base.
Yeah.
So that looks very, you know, grass free.
Yeah.
Once it's greened up a little bit, it'll look great. She'll sort of start to weather a little, you know, mossy perhaps.
Then
in a semi-circle behind her will be a double row of quite large posts that stand out of the ground a couple of meters.
Amazing. So is that almost in tribute to the posts of the other thing? When you first had the posts, I didn't get the context, but now I do.
Those posts will sort of, they're a nod towards that prehistoric prehistoric monuments of the past. And what we just want people to come, enjoy, take some time there, spend some time, enjoy that landscape.
Yeah. Why is it important to do this? You know, things like this that you're doing, which you've done a few things like this, you know, with the labyrinth that was in Overseal, the kind of work that you've done around the Anchor Caves. We went up and did some work in you know, and also even the Willington thing we did when we went to look at the burial man there and all that sort of stuff.
Yes.
Why should we be bothered about that? Why should we be interested in these kind of things? What is it?
Because it's so long ago, isn't it?
Mm.
It's stuff from the past. And we were doing some work on a Roman road in Branston, and there's a lovely group of people who in Branston called Branston Friends Group, and they came out on a cold sort of, was it January or February, really foggy morning. And I was anticipating the Branston Friends Group that I know of, they regularly get 15, 20 people.
Yeah.
86 people turned out. So something was going on.
Yeah.
I mean, there were so many people I couldn't even take their
names.
We just had to ask them to write their names on a list.
Yeah.
You know, but they were clearing brambles off the remains of, there's a 200 meter section of Roman Road. And in an urban setting, that's really quite rare. So they were helping to pull the brambles and, you know, off that.
Yeah.
At a time when it's not going to affect bird life, nesting, that kind of thing.
So, yeah. Yeah.
Then we'd sort of celebrated that on social media, and we did get a negative comment, and it was one person said, why are you doing that? The roads are gone. Let them go. Mm. We don't need them anymore.
Yeah.
And I kind of understand why you would say that. We don't need them anymore. But what these things represent, in my opinion, is a link to our past, and that gives us a sense of place.
Yeah.
We can build our identities on that. So you and I are from Derbyshire.
Yes.
So we have, or where are you from? Derbyshire, number one, Derbyshire, or English,
yeah,
or British,
yeah,
from Derbyshire, and then from your town or village or street or whatever.
Mm.
And that is part of your identity. So when I learnt a few years ago that Overseal hasn't always been in Derbyshire, it spent nearly 1,000 years since the formation of the Shires in Leicestershire.
Yeah.
When I tell people that who are from Overseal, they are, and I was the same when I first learned it.
Mm.
I'm not from Leicestershire. Derbyshire, born and bred.
Yeah, okay, yeah, well.
But you're not.
Born and bred.
Exactly.
Yeah, born and bred.
So you are from a place, and these things are about identity. So those landscapes form part of your identity.
Mm.
Where you are from has a very strong formation. Let me phrase this properly. You build your identity about from where you are.
Yeah.
Whether you are a Yorkshireman, a Scotsman, a Welshman, North Welshman, South Welshman, you know, or I'm from Nottingham, I'm from Derby, I'm from Overseal.
Yes. Yeah. Know? Yeah.
But actually my family are from all over the place, as is everyone else's.
You
form your identity about where you are. When we saw and people connect very closely with things.
Yeah.
Particularly trees, fields, whether you used to play when they were kids, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And you form identities around those.
A great example of that was that tree that got in Northumberland. Yeah, We've spoken about that before.
The Sycamore Gap tree.
Yeah,
yes,
we probably have spoken about identity
on that before. And people were distraught that tree had been cut down. And it was the same in Sheffield a few years ago when they were cutting down street trees.
Mm.
We have trees in our village that were planted after the First World War to represent the soldiers that had never come back from the First World War. And these things have meaning.
They're important.
They're important to us.
Yeah.
To us all, I think.
To the bigger human story than the self.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's the big one, isn't it?
That's right.
The person that you were talking to
is
it, or the person that made that comment was very much in the now, very much in the present and the self.
Yeah.
And potentially the ego. And,
yeah, that's right.
And,
yeah.
And it's
well,
that.
I don't know that person.
No.
They're probably a lovely person, you know.
Yeah.
But they'd not really.
And that's a point that people might share.
Yeah.
But I think it's important to not think of yourself as too important.
Oh, it really is. It really is. You know, we're here for a moment.
Yeah.
We're gone. The things we've done won't matter.
Mm.
You know, they won't matter. Certainly won't matter to us. They might matter in future to other people.
I just remember the walk you did. Sorry, I'm interrupting. I'm blurting.
No, that's okay.
The walk that you did that we all went on, and you said you put a message out. And you said, "Oh yeah, we'll get some people. It'll be all right. It might be a few of us." And I turned up expecting like exactly what you've just said about the Branston group, but you know, expecting I don't know 5 or 10 maybe.
Yeah.
And everyone has a walk and see. Loads of people showed up.
They did. Yeah.
Lots of people came
and they had a great time.
And interested, really interested.
They because they want to know about where they're from.
Yeah.
You know, because most people don't remember, you know, beyond their grandparents.
No, so absolutely,
We don't know our family history well, most of us, unless you've spent time researching it. We don't know our family history. We don't really know the place we're from very well, you know. and we don't know its history.
Yeah.
You know, it's just one of those things. And when you do, you get that deeper sense of connection with the place, where your place, the bit that matters to you.
Mm.
And I think that's key
to
what we're doing.
Yeah.
You know, what we're doing with transforming the Trent Valley Project, with Staffordshire Wildlife Trust, with other groups, creating. So we're creating, in the instance we're just talking about, this goddess sculpture, she might stand in the landscape for 200, 300, 500 years.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
We'll all be long forgotten.
Yeah.
So why would we bother? Why do we? But I think it's about recognizing there is a nowness to it, isn't there?
Yeah.
So encouraging people in the now to connect with the place, connect with deep connections with place and deep connections with time a little bit. And just feel part of a bigger thing.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's...
Yeah, that's really healthy, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It's important to me.
Mm.
And I know that, you know, we've done that as a team. That's a group effort.
Yeah.
We'll be forgotten.
Yeah.
She'll still be standing in the landscape, I hope.
Yeah.
For a very long time. And we as individuals don't matter. So it's not about an individual thing. It's not about an ego thing. It's just, this is, you know, I mean, of course I get a sense of...
That accomplishment.
Accomplishment out of it.
Yeah,
know,
yeah.
A personal sense of, we've done a brilliant thing here, haven't we?
Yeah. You know,
and we have.
Yeah.
We've done a brilliant thing. And I just hope that people come and enjoy it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But yeah, there's something going on here, because it's similar to when you create a piece of art, or when you create a song, or when you...
Yeah.
There is a point where you let go of that.
Oh, yeah, there is.
And, it's not yours anymore.
No, it's out in the world.
Yeah.
And just to have had some small part in the creation is very satisfying, but it's no longer your thing.
No.
And I think, I guess, some things are difficult to let go of and some aren't.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I'm happy for it to go into the world and be its thing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It is. And it's a joy to have been part of.
Yeah. What's next? What are you going to do next?
Well, the thing is, so funding for our project ends on March the 31st, and we've just had the confirmation that we have funding for a development project from April the 1st. We've got 18 months worth of work to develop a bigger project.
Oh, wow.
So we head upstream.
Yeah.
So we're going up to the source of the River Trent, on Biddulph Moor, which is sort of Staffordshire Moorlands sort of area, a bit to the west of that maybe, but it's just beyond Stoke.
So this goes bigger.
Bigger.
It's already a big thing. It's a thing. And you let go of the little big thing, and then you go on to the big, big thing.
For me, it's about connecting communities.
Yeah.
Getting people to love the place. I think generally they do love where they're from. I want those communities to be involved in the space.
Yeah.
Because it's very easy. And I don't know how much of a modern world thing it is. I think it's quite modern, that series of boxes.
Yeah.
We live in a box. We go home to our box. We watch the box.
Yeah.
Then we get up and we get into another box and we drive to we commute to our place, our box of work.
Yeah.
And then we do go back again and we don't connect with the community around us. And it's often been said that Overseal has got a vibrant community, which it has.
Mm.
That's, it's not so of other places.
Yeah.
They really have.
Yeah, but what about?
yeah. What about my place?
Yeah.
Well, you've got, I'm sure you've all got lovely places that your community is strong in.
Have they got a labyrinth? Have they?
Have they got a wassail?
Have they got the wassail? Yeah.
But they've got their own thing. But we've become a commuter village with the sort of, the end of industrial work in our area.
Yeah.
The advent of the National Forest, the development of our village's identity, all our villages around this area, their identity is changing, like it or not.
Yeah.
It is and it has. And we have become essentially a dormitory village with lots and lots of people from the West Midlands, talking a little bit funny with their little funny accents that they've got. But they come into our village and they generally love it because they've moved from a town to a village. So they've got that kind of village community feel.
Yeah.
They are able to take part in all sorts of community activities, or just the fact that they're there, whether they take part in them or not, the fact that there's a community spirit is important to these people, and I love them for that. The fact that they, for the most part, join in, take part, want to be part of the community, want to connect, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
So, I hope that
anywhere that's got a gala, really, isn't it?
Anywhere that's got a gala, yeah. but it's all part of that.
Yeah.
That sense of connection that we tend to lose, and so this next part of the bigger. Not the bigger picture. The next part of the project, I hope, will connect communities with each other, with their landscapes. We'll be able to find out more about, you know, whatever's exciting upstream of where we've been working. So that's part of it. But we've also got some. We're also continuing to do some focus. I've just had notification that today.
It's been a good day.
It's been a good day. It's been a great day. That we are developing. What I hope will be a series of 3D models of the Cato ceremonial complex. So they will be in digital space.
Yeah.
And with those 3D models, as we have talked about before, we can do all sorts of things. We can create art, representational art, so people can see what was in the landscape. Because remember, this was of national importance.
Yeah, yeah.
As important as the Wessex landscapes, your Salisbury Plains, your Stonehenges, as important. But because it's wood, it's disappeared.
Yeah.
So we can recreate that so that people, because it is really difficult to begin to visualise this stuff.
Mm.
If you've not got, you know, a background in archaeology, how can you even begin? And even then, you're kind of making it up.
Yeah,
we know the tree trunks were this big. We know they were that far apart.
Yeah.
After that, it's open to some
some educated guesswork, isn't it?
So we will be able to create three-dimensional models which we can create artwork. We can hopefully get that kind of VR, you know, virtual reality, augmented reality experience. We will hopefully be able to work, you and I will be able to work together on soundscapes, because I think that'll be quite an exciting prospect.
I've got a good toy for that.
I know. So if you were immersed in that, you know, all those rows of posts around you, and you were a group of people chanting, what would that sound like? What would the audio effect be?
So
there's a lot of exciting stuff in the virtual world.
Yes.
And of course then we can also create a 3D model of that space, so you can actually go and have a look at it. I don't know how we, this is all for the future. But we've got the artist who is now able to do that work for us.
Wow.
So that's an exciting thing for here.
Yeah.
And then up the Trent to the source to find out what's there.
Oh.
I mean, people already know, but you know, I don't. So one of the things I want to have a think about over the next 18 months that maybe we'll get a project out of is the intersection of spirituality and landscape.
Yeah.
So that crossover, how has landscape affected the way we feel spiritually?
Yeah.
And how have our spiritual responses to that affected the landscape? So by which I mean, we've created enclosed spaces, burial mounds in prehistory.
Yeah.
And then into sort of more modern-ish times with the advent of Christianity, the sort of how monks sought out solitary spaces as a group of men or females, you know, in priories, you know, female priories, where they went out into what was wild space, what was effectively desert space.
Yeah.
I don't mean desert as in sand desert.
No,
it's deserted, wilder spaces. So on Staffordshire, on Staffordshire Moorlands, for example, an abbey was created that was out in the wilds at that time, called Halton Abbey.
Right,
and they changed the landscape. They cut down trees. They created meadows. They had sheep for a wool economy, which England had in the sort of mid to late medieval period. So they affected the landscape because of their spiritual beliefs. They wanted to be out somewhere wild, but they also needed to be able to live.
Yeah.
And eventually make an awful lot of money out of the wool trade. Yeah. So they've affected the landscape by building a stonking great abbey in it. Out on a hill somewhere near the Trent, on the edge of the moorland. But then they've affected that moorland by making it into a place. They farmed it.
Yes. They farmed it.
And then now that Hulton Abbey is no more, there is almost nothing to see because it's all under grass, except for one area where it was the Abbey Church.
Right.
And it's just the ruins of it. It's essentially the foundations of it.
Yeah.
It's in a green space, but it's entirely surrounded now by housing estates, industrial places. You know, it's a town. It's effectively, and it's used as the kind of local park.
Yeah.
So well used for dog walkers, that kind of thing. You know, it's also the kind of stuff that you used to do when you were a teenager.
Yeah.
Find some way to go out, drink a can of cider, have a laugh with your mates, ride your bike around.
Yeah.
But what people see is antisocial behaviour.
Yes.
So, tin cans everywhere, fag ends everywhere, crisp packets everywhere.
Yeah.
So it's how do we connect the communities with that space again?
Yes.
So that it will be loved in more ways than just being able to, you know, go for a jog or take your dog for a walk.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or go and drink cider with your mates. But, you know, so that everybody will be able to love this space again. But it's by doing that research into the sort of spiritual landscape crossover that I hope we'll be able to develop a project.
Yeah, this is very interesting. Blind Boy, who I almost never talk about, has got a sort of bit of an idea. And it's not quite a hot take. I think there's some kind of reality behind it. But this concept of, you know, the stories that you tell within spaces are often to affect behaviors and beliefs. The big one that he always refers to is about the well system, you know, in Ireland, and people treated them as sacred because, sort of things, and whether they're sacred or not, they're important places.
Yeah.
So you have to look after them. You don't want to throw rubbish down there because that's everyone's drinking water. And
it's bad luck to do that.
Exactly. And I wonder if a similar thing happens with the way you play with space.
I wonder maybe. Yeah. But I find all those things like holy wells really that connection with spirituality and water.
Is
really,
and the other world as well.
And the other
they're
world.
Like portals almost.
So just touching back to that prehistoric landscape, where with the confluence of the three rivers, that would have been a quite marshy space. So it's great for being able to find things to eat, but it's also that space between spaces, you know, between water and between dry land. It's that marsh. So it would have been, we've drained the land. We can't, it's even difficult to even comprehend how wet England was before we drained it. But it would have been a kind of, the river was alive in more than one sense.
Yeah.
It was alive in that it was dynamic and moved. It had more than one course. We've channeled it all into a single river course. And it's very straight in places, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it would have been anastomized is the word, a braided river, lots of different channels. And one of them might have been the main channel at one point, and it would have swapped around as the, you know, through the, almost through the seasons. There's that sort of, it's alive in that sense, but people in the past viewed it as being alive,
being
a spirit. You know, so this goddess sculpture represents that goddess of the river. The goddess represented the river, but the river was the goddess. In ways that I think we find it difficult to comprehend.
Because we're not dualistic anymore, are we? That the right word?
We don't connect in that way. Dualism is a kind of you know, black and white kind of thing.
And we sort of
it's the grey bits in between.
We don't see the interconnections. We don't see the interplay.
And so, that's where we've got to, where we are.
Yeah.
There will be a short film that my colleague and I are putting together.
Yeah.
And this podcast.
Yeah.
And press release. But most importantly, go and visit.
Brilliant. All right. Here's to the next one.
Indeed.